Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 7 years ago, a devastating fire consumed three buildings at Polartech fleecemaker Malden Mills. It seemed to be just another story of a struggling town facing yet another setback. But soon the nation would pay attention. Outside the mill in Lawrence, Massachusetts, Fire Chief Ken Barassa described what he saw.
All of them are gone. Due to the 45-mile-an-hour winds, the zero-degree temperature, and just how fast this, how amazingly fast this fire traveled.
Malden Mills was the area's largest employer and a bright spot in an otherwise poor and largely Hispanic neighborhood. 2,400 workers believe their livelihoods were turning to ash. Mill worker Wally Jamnick.
What's the company going to do? Are we going to rebuild? Are we going to move? What's left? Is it worth saving? What can we do? I guess the big boys will decide today.
But just one day after the fire, Malden Mills owner Aaron Feuerstein stunned his employees and the nation.
We're going to continue to operate here in Lawrence. We had our opportunity to run to the south many years ago, and we didn't do it then, and we're not going to do it now.
Aaron Feuerstein spent millions of dollars of his own money to pay 1,800 temporarily unemployed workers up to 3 months of salary. In 1996, Feuerstein replaced the burned buildings. Now he's waging a fight to hold on to Malden Mills. He has 19 days to raise $92 million, or he loses everything. He swears that a unionized textile mill in America can be profitable, but free market economists wonder how. Tonight on Point, the future of Malden Mills and U.S. manufacturing. Does manufacturing still have a place in the United States? Did Aaron Feuerstein, the Übermensch, undermine Aaron Feuerstein, the businessman? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now live is Aaron Feuerstein. A very warm welcome to you,
sir. Thank you very much.
Can I just ask you, how is that search for the $92 million going?
Very successfully. I expect on August 27th, which is the deadline in the consensual plan, which means the plan that's in front of the court, which is agreed to by lenders and me, that plan calls for an August 27th deadline, and I have to come up with a certain set amount of money, and I will have it. And I'm going to exercise the option.
And how short are you of that $92 million at the moment?
I don't think I'm short at all.
So you've got it all?
Yes. All I have to do now is just finalize it and get it all, concrete, tangible. And sometimes that's a little bit difficult, but we're doing it.
So you're nearly there, but can Malden Mills itself ever be profitable, do you think?
Absolutely.
And what makes you say that?
Well, because we have a business strategy which I know can make an American manufacturing-based textile fabric mill profitable.
And what are the major ingredients of that?
Three. One, we're determined and dedicated to make the best quality in the world, and in that way differentiate ourselves from the global commodity market. Two, we back that up with a brand, and we don't in any way prostitute that brand. We keep that brand up. It only goes to the best companies in Europe, the best companies in the U.S., and that's the way we operate it. So that brand is good, the quality is right, and we back both those things up with innovation R&D. So a great deal of financial and human resources go into brand and into R&D in our company. And that's why we are going to absolutely win with American manufacturing base.
Why, though, 7 years ago did you rebuild in Lawrence, Massachusetts, rather than relocate to Asia or South America? You clearly still believe then in the American product.
Oh, absolutely. We at that time, were making the very best quality in the world. That very best quality was a direct result of the quality workers that we had in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And why would I be crazy enough to take the major part of our business strategy and lose it in order to get cheaper labor someplace else?
I mean, it's harsh out there, isn't it, trying to raise the money. One of those approach for finances is reported to have said it's a dead market. He's an old guy. What keeps you going?
Well, first of all, I'm not old. And secondly, yes, it was difficult being in the chapter, but we have tremendous assets. Our company actually has on the books $190 million of fixed assets. And over and above that, which is not on our books, is $100 million of intellectual assets, our brand and our patents, etc. And so we have enough assets. And between getting new debt, new equity, and some federal guarantees, there's no question that we have the money.
You clearly feel that you can stand on your own two feet. But overall, should the government be doing more, do you think, to help America's manufacturers?
I think the government ought to do more and come up with creative ideas of how to help. Not to help in the 20th century way, which was via quotas and duties to protect a mature industry, but they ought to come up with creative ways how to help those industries which are creative and which are innovative. And we are. We not only create new textiles, we are moving as rapidly as possible, and we're pioneering the idea of electronic textiles. We work very hard with the Natick Labs, and we're doing it.
Okay, well, let's bring into the conversation J. David Richardson. He's also here in the studio, Professor of Economics and International Relations, Syracuse University, Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Welcome to you. You've heard Aaron Feuerstein's business plan. It seems to make pretty good sense to me. Why can't he make a go of it?
I'm not among those economists who thinks he cannot. I'm actually one who studied apparel firms to some extent in the United States, and there's a number of them with exactly his business plan who are making a go of it, even though they're under constant pressure and must change almost from day to day the tactics involved in that business plan. So I think he'll succeed, actually. But the debt overhang that he has caused him much grief and much compromise, as is fairly well known.
So what are the elements of his plan, do you believe, that give him an edge that would enable him to see off foreign competition?
Malden Mills, for a number of years, has pioneered a fabric known as PolarTech. And PolarTech is still, in fact, a patented asset of Malden Mills, and they have been among the leaders in the research and development they've done as a share of their revenues and sales. Mr. Feuerstein mentioned the idea of electronic fabrics or intelligent fabrics. This is a cutting edge that most people are not aware of that is going to revolutionize apparel. And American firms are leading the way, and the government's actually supporting some of the lab work that's being done in these regards. So he's on the cutting edge.
Malden Mills, though, is an exception, isn't it, to the overall pattern of manufacturing?
Yes. No, let me correct you. Malden Mills is an exception to the pattern in apparel and in textiles and in footwear and in leather. Otherwise, in manufacturing in the United States, employment is fairly stable over the years. That's not well known, but it's not growing, granted. But these weaker, competitively exposed sectors are the ones in which there's drastic shrinkage, and he's an exception to that.
Okay, let's take a call from Peter. He's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Good evening to you, Peter.
Good evening.
And what would you like to say?
Well, from 1932 until 1990, my family purchased Malden Mill products to make suede and leather coats in Peabody, New England sportswear. And we went out of business in 1990. But it was an uphill battle to survive, and ultimately that last recession killed us. And I'm just wondering how you can think about competing against low-priced Asian imports and why you didn't go overseas to produce your product as opposed to staying in Lawrence.
Let me just ask you Fiorentino. I mean, to a certain extent, you've answered that question already, which is that you're going to be concentrating on quality.
Right. That's part of the answer. The other part of the answer is, and they were a very good firm, that New England Sportswear Company, but they were a labor-intensive apparel manufacturing company, and we are a fabric mill making an ingredient, a brand. So the New England Sportswear Company has to buy fabric from us. And then they have a lot of labor-intensive work in their factory. That labor-intensive work, based on government policy, has moved offshore. It's moved to Asia, and it's moved to the Caribbean Basin, which is called here the CBI, the Caribbean Basin Initiative. And the Caribbean Basin Initiative, we can make fabric, which is primarily a capital-intensive, not labor-intensive, because we have the best equipment, and we can make fabric and send it into the Caribbean, and then the Caribbean sends it back to the U.S. retail shops, and we can beat Asia in that operation. And the government, that's one of the creative things that the government is doing, and we're part and parcel of it. And so, yes, it's doable.
J. David Richardson.
It is doable on that model. Another firm with which I'm familiar has 100 employees in Cumberland, Maryland, and they don't make fabric, but they broker between retailers and overseas manufacturers, and their employees are now more brokers than apparel workers, but they've made a go of it because they're so good at brokering in the retail market.
But should the United States be more actively creating policies, in your opinion, to protect its manufacturers?
Not overall. Inevitably, some manufacturing is done more effectively abroad for less cost, and Mr. Feuerstein has said so, essentially. The labor-intensive part of the industry almost surely will end up abroad. But the capital-intensive part of the industry and the technology-intensive part of the industry is going to stay right here, where both capital and technology are strong. And he's in that part of the industry, and I suspect if he succeeds in the next few days, he'll be here in a year and 10 years.
What about your relationship with labor, with your workforce?
We have a union. And it's the outgrowth of the needle trade, because when my grandfather started, we were in the sweater business, and that was the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and that finally became Unite, which is a combination of both AFL and CIO, and we work with them. We negotiate very hard, and we do what we think is right and just. We never had a strike. I don't think we ever will have a strike because there's mutual trust, and that's critically important. But we never had a stoppage.
But what you pay your workers?
We pay the workers. The union workers are being paid approximately $12.50 an hour, and burdened, if you figure the burden of the medical expenses and the other benefits, it comes to about $18 an hour.
And you can still be competitive with that kind of wage bill.
Yeah, that's right. On two counts, I can be competitive because I'm capital intensive, and I can be competitive because of this Caribbean basin. And once I finally get out and I write some books on the subject, which I intend to do, we'll figure out how the government could do other creative things which could help industry that's high technology.
Okay, Aaron Ferenstein, we must take a break. Stay with us, and you too, J. David Richardson, Professor of Economics and International Relations at Syracuse University. We're talking tonight about Malden Mills and the future of manufacturing in the United States. Are you prepared to pay more for Made in the USA products? Do you even care where your clothing and cars are made? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. On Point, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Malden Mills, and if the U.S. manufacturing sector can keep up in our global economy, do you admire Aaron Ferenstein, but buy foreign fleeces? Can the United States lose more manufacturing jobs overseas? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Aaron Ferenstein, owner and chief executive of Malden Mills, which makes Polartec fleece. Also with us is J. David Richardson, professor of economics and international relations at Syracuse University and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Joining us from Washington is Robert Scott, international economist at the Economic Policy Institute and co-author of Jobs on the Wing, Trading Away the Future of the U.S. Aerospace Industry. Robert Scott, do you see a future for manufacturing in the United States?
Well, certainly. I think that there's no question that we have to continue to produce goods in this country. We've lost about 3 million manufacturing jobs overall since June of 1998, but we've still got about 14 million people employed in manufacturing industries.
And how, therefore, do you keep manufacturing in America?
Well, I think that Mr. Ferenstein has certainly got one key ingredient, that is to invest in high-technology goods, to produce with constant innovation using capital-intensive production techniques. I think that's those are some of the keys to surviving in manufacturing these days. But manufacturing industries do need some help from the government. One of the main things that they need right now is help with the overvalued U.S. dollar. The dollar has gained about 25% in value since 1995, and this has made U.S. goods much less competitive. And so I think that there are things the government needs to do, both at the industry level and at the national level that is influenced by the Department of Treasury, that is to move the exchange rate down.
Okay,
I think there are steps need to be taken here.
Let's take a call from Fred in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Fred, what would you like to say?
Yes, I would like to notice. I noticed that recently the pressures from overseas, where our companies that have been traveling, the economic forces that they're having to take into account seem not to be as favorable as they used to be. Several other things that I've noticed from this country where the pressures to move overseas have been reduced. I simply believe that it may take several decades before the market will support the U.S. Innovative, technologically sound companies that it had from the beginning of the economic revolution. Okay.
We heard earlier Aaron Ferenstein saying that he intends to build, or rather produce, quality made in America products. Would you, as an individual, Fred, choose to say buy those more expensive products over something cheaper from abroad?
Yes, I would. In fact, I produce things of my own of a higher quality. I'm a journeyman electrician and a union member, and as such, I intend to produce a quality product, and I can appreciate his standpoint, and what he insists upon is something that I personally believe is the only thing that is keeping our country above everyone else who can produce these things across the new global market.
Aaron Ferenstein, would you like to see greater patriotism, if you like, amongst American consumers? Is that a way forward?
Well, I would like to see greater patriotism amongst the CEOs. The battle of losing the manufacturing base in the United States belongs to everyone, and the CEOs have the most prominent position and are in a position to really count. And this recklessness that's going on today of permitting the manufacturing base to go, which ultimately causes some very bad dislocations in our country. You have laborers who used to make products and could hold their heads high that they had a decent job and could support their children and support their families, now have to take a job making beds, service job in the Hilton Hotel. That's not good. And even though the unemployment shows not a good situation, but the unemployment still shows that when the guy who made $40,000 a year had to accept a job for $15,000 a year, he's still employed. And what's happening is that the spread between those who are making good money in the U.S. and those who are laboring is, as that spread gets greater and greater, you could lose your democracy in this country.
J. David Richardson, do CEOs have part of the responsibility for the erosion of the U.S. manufacturing base?
Well, the U.S. manufacturing base has not eroded. It's a myth that that's so. In terms of output and as a share of American total output, manufacturing base is pretty intact. And
Challenge the figures, though, the job losses in the industry.
There's a difference between employment decline, which has taken place as a share of total employment, and flat employment, which is what the projections are. The Labor Department says there will be 16 million manufacturing workers here in 2005. There's slightly less today because of the recession, as Rob said. But there were 16 million workers in the late 1980s, and there were slightly over that, 18 million in the early 70s. Employment has been flat. It has not been declining. Output has been rising fast because of the productivity and the commitment to quality and research and development that Mr. Feuerstein has been practicing, in fact.
Robert Scott, do you see it that way?
No, I think that we've had some structural declines in manufacturing employment. I think what's happened is that manufacturers have been progressively outsourcing production both within the United States and also to increasingly to foreign locations, and that this has accelerated during the current downturn because of the factors we were discussing before, the overvalued dollar and the failure of the government to develop aggressive policies to support our manufacturing industries.
J. David Richardson?
I'd like to add something to that. And I agree with Mr. Scott. And furthermore, it's not just the union laborer who is relatively educationally unskilled, but what's happening today is that you're losing a lot of competent, educated laborers to foreign countries. I spoke just recently to the most profitable a company that handles the capital for the most profitable company in the United States, and they said that their back room of accountants, which were making anywhere from $40,000 to $125,000, that they outsourced 80% of that back room. And they gave the jobs to India, where the same workers were making in around the $10,000 mark and were considered amongst the richest people in town. And this push for laboratory workers and accountants and financial people and all that going out of the country, if that kind of outsourcing over and above the outsourcing in the mature industries of the production worker, if that continues, I can't imagine how you're going to be able to keep the employment figures so that you don't have a depression in this country.
J. David Richardson.
The employment figures have been flat. That's the facts. And the reason for that is there's as much outsourcing being done by foreign firms to American firms as there is in the other direction. That's outsourcing you never hear about because it adds to American jobs. It's taking place in manufacturing. It's taking place in services. We're a large producer of components for the world's products, and the world buys them from our own manufacturers. We're a large producer of financial and insurance services for the world, and the world buys them from our producers. We gain from outsourcing abroad as much as we lose from outsourcing there. And may I say, I don't think the government needs to do anything special about manufacturing as an industry, but the government does need to do something about workers as individuals. Where we need new programs in this country is on the worker level to help them cope with change, to help educate them for a global economy, to help them carry with them the benefits that they have in their current workplace so that when they have to change workplaces, they don't lose benefits, and to have a wage insurance system that, in fact, compensates them for part of the wage losses that they may have to take when they're dislocated.
Robert Scott, the workers have got to change to the adapting world marketplace.
Well, I think that that's they are certainly changing, but I think it's not necessarily so. I think that there are other countries in Europe, for example, that have maintained high wages and high levels of employment in manufacturing industries that we simply haven't been able to keep up with. And I think the way in which they do that is that they invest heavily in R&D and in industrial policies, and they emphasize policies to promote their manufacturing industries.
Okay, let's take a call from Daniel in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Good evening, Daniel.
Good evening.
And what would you like to say?
I first of all, I just want to say that Mr. Fierenstein is just a total hero of mine, and I've been making things with his fabric just as an average person, not as a manufacturer, for many years. And I just want to say that as a regular citizen, I go out of my way to the point of saving up and buying things that might be more expensive because they're made in America. And I just, I mean, what else is there to do besides buying those things that can help people like him stay in business?
Okay, thanks for that, Daniel. Let's hear from Greg in North Haven, Connecticut. Greg.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I'm enjoying the program, and I just wanted to call out to comment. I deal in the machine tool industry and the metalworking industry, and we have a number of customers that are U.S. government contractors building jet aircraft engines and so forth. And I recently read in the USA Today, I don't recall the senator, but there's a senator who's trying to have a bill initiative that these government contract companies, private companies that are doing government contracts, should be required to buy primarily U.S.-built machine tools. And right now they're primarily buying German and foreign machine tools, Japanese and German machine tools. And I just wonder what their thoughts were on the government passing such a bill that would force companies like United Technologies and GE to purchase U.S.-manufactured machine tools.
J. David Richardson?
I think that's a bad idea because the governments that you're describing are buying still very standardized machine tools from abroad. High-end machine tools, as you well know better than I, are still being made in this country and marketed in close proximity to United Technologies and other companies because you're the ones who can provide the upfront give and take that's necessary with a high-end machine tool to make it work right.
Aaron Feuerstein.
I tend to disagree. This is the first time this evening with Richardson. It's I think unhealthy for our country. We won the Civil War. The North won the Civil War only because of its manufacturing base. The South had to bring everything in from England and France. The First World War was won because of our manufacturing base. The Second World War was, which I believe was the saving of the Western civilization, was won because of our manufacturing base. And to give away the manufacturing base, even in the military, I think is sort of, I think it's crazy. It's a type of suicide. The last time I was down in Washington, I walked into a senator's office, remained unmentioned, his name, but he came over to me, and I never saw him before, and he hugged me. And he said, you know why I'm hugging you? Because you're the first man coming in from industry for military contracts who isn't trying to tell me why I should permit outsourcing as part of the deal. You're prepared to make it all in the U.S.
J. David Richardson.
Making it all in the U.S. is simply inefficient. We waste resources, and we don't fight wars well when we're wasting resources. Modern war is not going to be won with manufacturing. I think we've seen that in the past decade. What I favor is maintaining as much technological leadership in all of manufacturing and services as we have maintained and keeping that going and government support for it. I think that's the key to our success. Then, relying on cheaper, more effectively made imports for the standardized and commodified ends of both manufacturing and services.
Robert Scott, that does seem to make good business sense for the United States to be a lot more selective about the kinds of things that it does manufacture.
Well, I think the government has an obligation to use its purchasing power to stimulate U.S. Manufacturing industries. I think Mr. Feuerstein is right on that. I think that we have to use the immense purchasing power of the military and the U.S. government to help rebuild U.S. manufacturing. We've lost these 3 million jobs now in the last 5 years, and I think that unless we begin to pay attention to this problem, we're going to really impoverish much of the working class in this country, which I think we have to remember still makes up about three-quarters of a labor force, that is, people who have a college degree or less. And I think that right now we're at great risk of disenfranchising those people by driving down their wages and trading with countries that simply don't respect property rights, that have wages that are, on the order of 10 cents an hour or less in China and elsewhere in Southeast Asia.
Aaron Feuerstein, I mean, presumably a lot of what you were doing there in Lawrence was also trying to protect a community as well, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
And to you, that was important.
Very, very important. The night of the fire, yes, it was important to give the people their wages because it was just a couple weeks before Christmas and a freezing winter. But there was something more important than that, and that is that all the textile mills in Lawrence, all that had made big money during the course of the 20th century, had all pulled out for cheaper labor elsewhere, and the whole community was there that night in the fire, and they were watching me, what is Malden going to do? If we're going to do the same thing, then their souls are lost.
We must take a break there. Aaron Feuerstein, owner and chief executive of Malden Mills, also with us, J. David Richardson, Professor of Economics and International Relations at Syracuse University, and Robert Scott, International Economist at the Economic Policy Institute. We're discussing Aaron Feuerstein's fight to hold on to Malden Mills. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Support for this program. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Malden Mills and whether the United States is hemorrhaging manufacturing jobs. Are rising labor costs the death knell of U.S. manufacturing? Do you admire Aaron Feuerstein, but buy foreign fleeces? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-825. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Aaron Feuerstein, owner and chief executive of Malden Mills, which makes Polartec fleece. Also with us is J. David Richardson, a professor of economics and international relations at Syracuse University and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Joining us also from Washington, Robert Scott, international economist at the Economy Policy Institute and co-author of Jobs on the Wing, Trading Away the Future of the U.S. aerospace industry. Aram Feuerstein, you're intending, if you do manage to regain control of Malden Mills, to manufacture, well, just to put it in shorthand, sort of high-tech fleeces. But aren't third world countries doing that already?
No, they're not. And we here in Boston have a great opportunity because I don't have to do the basic research on the electronic items. They're electronic items that have been created here in Massachusetts to figure out what the blood pressure is of the human being and of what the pulse is, etc. And all that, what we have to do is incorporate the creativity into textiles, and I think that's going to open up a new textile market, which is far, far greater than anything that ever was. So at the very moment when most of the commodity companies think they have to move out of this country in order to make a living, we, who don't make the commodity type of thing, but are trying to make textile high-tech materials, think we have the greatest opportunity ever.
Let's take a call from Ed in Chicago, Illinois. Good evening to you, Ed. What would you like to say?
Yes, sir. Am I on?
Yes, you are indeed.
Certainly. My question is, the exchange rate from these third world countries is one of the driving forces in the pull to industry and the profit margins that they would receive if they moved. What kind of altered state would occur as these countries begin to move toward parity with the exchange rate with the U.S. dollar? As our dollar falls and their economies may pick up, as they receive our business and work in their countries.
Okay, thanks for that, Ed. J. David Richardson, if you'd like to reply, if you could understand that rather bad telephone line.
Yes, it's a good question, Ed, and I want Rob to respond to it, too. The exchange rate adjustment that's needed is primarily an Asian currency adjustment, and Asian currencies need to rise in value. It's not an adjustment toward Europe or Canada, and almost everyone agrees on this, and it has begun taking place, but it still has a ways to go. When that happens, some of these pressures will become much less intense than they have been, and we won't be worried about the end of the world or the end of the manufacturing world.
Robert Scott?
Yes, the Chinese government has been intervening heavily for more than a decade. They've acquired more than $100 billion in U.S. assets, which is a massive amount. The U.S. has has actually decreased the amount of reserves it has acquired in the last decade with the changes in technology that are speeding electronic transactions and banking information and so forth. So clearly the Chinese are intervening extensively in foreign exchange markets, and they're doing it in such a way as to depress the incomes of their own citizens. And I think it's time for the U.S. Treasury Department to intervene and to begin to challenge the Chinese on these extreme market distortions. The Chinese currency has been frozen in value since 1994, so the exchange rate has been fixed.
Aram Feuerstein, I mean, how do you feel as a relatively kind of small manufacturer, but somebody who nonetheless wants to make a success of what they're doing, about all these external factors, the kinds of things that we've just been hearing about, exchange rate manipulation or whatever?
Well, as far as the exchange rate is concerned, I mean, the professors are absolutely correct. The China, by having an artificial rate instead of letting the thing float, has got an advantage. I don't know just what it is. I think it's around a 25% advantage. And it's unfair. But I got the gut feeling, even though I have not studied it, that even if you let the Chinese, force the Chinese to float their currency over and above that 25% difference, which is a tremendous difference, they would manage because of the difference in the labor rate and the difference in their environmental standards and other standards. They would manage to steal our manufacturing base unless the government comes in not with protection of quotas and not with protections of duties, but with creative ideas of how to help industry to be technologically better and to pay its employees here. And I think that that's what has to be done.
J. David Richardson, do I assume that you are against that kind of a government intervention?
Well, the Chinese are not out to steal our manufacturing base, but they are, in fact, the center of much of standardized manufacturing of commodity-like products in the future. That's inevitable. That's going to happen more slowly if the exchange rates adjust in the right way, but it's going to happen sooner or later. So that I agree with Mr. Feirstein in everything except that phrase, stealing the American manufacturing base.
Robert Scott, would you use that phrase, stealing the American manufacturing base?
Yes, I think it's absolutely appropriate. I think that the Chinese are intervening consciously every day to purchase more and more billions of dollars of U.S. currency to depress the value of their currency. We import now six times more from China than we export to them. I think there's never been another country in history that has had this kind of a trading relationship, and they remain closed to imports of many kinds from the United States. They maintain active policies to build up excess capacity in a wide range of industries, which is distorting world trade. And I think it's time that we recognize that and begin to respond aggressively.
Chris is calling from Louisville, Kentucky. And Chris, you want to contribute to the debate?
Yes, I think a piece of this story has to be looking at, and relating to this, you brought up China, trade policy. The federal trade policy is really encouraging outsourcing. I'm a teacher, and over the last few years with my class, we've looked at where children's clothing is made. We graph that, and we just see that it's just overwhelmingly made in other locations. And what you can see when you look at the documents that come out, that there's really an encouraging of this outsourcing federally, supporting that. And there's no effort on the federal level to protect the rights of workers in those countries. And the rights of workers and the environment is not allowed to come on the table. The rights of our corporations to protect their patents for AIDS drugs and so forth is what matters. But that is not put on the table. And while at the same time this facade that globalization will raise Guatemalan peasants into a modern civilized, quote, civilized world is a farce, because they have the only reason my grandparents moved from the working class from dire circumstance when they immigrated here is because of unionizing and organizing and political action. And when people try to do that in China, if they're not in jail working in prisons or in Central America, they're crushed without any support. And I think that's why the efforts of groups like the National Labor Committee, other globalization organizations.
Okay, Chris. Well, look. Thanks for that. And I saw Aaron Feirstein nodding his head vigorously while you were talking.
Yeah, he's right on. He's right on. I agree with him.
But on what particular point?
I agree with the fact that that our government policy is insufficiently creative to figure out ways in which we could help our industry, especially the high technology and the more creative kind of industry, to make it here in this country. Yes, we have a patent protection for the inventor, But today, the inventor, the corporation that invents, on the very next day, outsources the invention. So the worker in the U.S. no longer is protected by the patent law, and it's unfortunate. I'm not expert in this, but there should be creative ways in which the government can help those industries which are not the mature old industries, but the good ones, to stay here in the U.S. and their workers to benefit from the fact that their corporations have excellent inventions.
Sir Robert Scott, what's holding the government back?
Well, I think that there is a laissez-faire approach in this government, a belief that the government is not needed to intervene in R&D. But I think we're giving away the store in our trade negotiations. I think we're sacrificing growing numbers of industries and promoting the flooding of investment out of this country. And I think that that it's time for the U.S. to begin to pay attention to the structure of its economy. We're certainly seeing that we're having rising inequality and falling wages in this country, and I think it's time for government to begin to look at its industrial sector. There are dozens of industries in this country that are facing excess capacity around the globe. It's been created with government intervention, and it's time for us to respond to that.
Richard's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Good evening, Richard.
Hi, good evening. Questions mostly to Mr. Richardson. I think he's not seeing the full cycle of things, and that it eventually always fails to outsource everything. By this I mean one of these countries will reach parity sooner or later. But when I was getting my master's degree at UMass Boston in structural design, we worshipped the Japanese model, Theory X, just-in-time delivery. Now I'm speaking to you on a Panasonic phone made in China. And Japan is hurting. They were the cheap labor market of the Pacific Rim at one time. Now they're hurting. What goes around comes around. In the long run, it doesn't work.
Today's
profits end up to bite you in the tush years later.
Richard, in the long run, what doesn't work?
Outsourcing everything.
We're not outsourcing everything. We have companies who are themselves benefiting from foreign outsourcing. What do you think Intel does?
Why does my Time magazine that just came in the mail this week talk about all the white-collar jobs going to India?
They're talking about standardized white-collar jobs, payroll jobs, low-level programming jobs. They're not talking about high-end engineering jobs.
Low-level, when an American makes $40,000 a year and an Indian makes $10,000 a year?
$40,000 is below the median American income. That's a low income.
But not to that family.
Of course not. But that family needs to tell its children that the world is changing and the workplace is changing. They need to learn foreign languages. They need to learn math and science way better than they are.
Okay, finally to you, Aaron Feuerstein, you've had a lot of economic advice one way and the other tonight, but you are still confident, despite all that you've heard, that you can make a success of Malden Mills again?
Absolutely. More confident than ever.
And what makes you so confident?
We have the proper strategy. We have the best quality laborers. We make the best quality. Our brand's good. Our innovation's the best in the industry. And we're going to win this ball game.
Aaron Feuerstein, I've been practicing that all day. Feuerstein, owner and chief executive of Malden Mills, which makes Polartec Fleece. Many thanks for being with us. Also to you, Jay Davis, David Richardson, professor of economics and international relations at Syracuse University and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. And you too in Washington, Robert Scott, international economist at the Economic Policy Institute and co-author of Jobs on the Wing, Trading Away the Future of the U.S. Aerospace Industry. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide.